Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from STAT. I'm Meg Terrell.
I'm Adam Feuerstein.
And I'm Damian Garde.
It's Thursday, July 15th, and here's what we're going to talk about this week.
Yeah, first we'll talk about the future of the FDA, whose acting commissioner will have to step down in November unless she's given the permanent job.
Next, Washington Post reporter Dan Diamond joins us to discuss the politics of the vaccine rollout and how covering this administration differs from the last one.
We'll start with some quick takes on this week in biotech, but first, a word from our sponsor.
Support for this podcast comes from Houston Methodist Hospital. Dr. James Musser and his colleagues at the Houston Methodist Research Institute sequenced 20,453 specimens from COVID-19 patients starting in March 2020. Visit the Leading Medicine blog on HoustonMethodist.org to learn more.
So, Meg, let's start with COVID, of course, and the dire predictions out there for the Delta variant. You actually had a conversation recently, I think, with the Arkansas Health Secretary.
I did. Dr. Jose Romero is also the chairman of the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices for the CDC. So I really wanted to talk with him, both in this context of all these arguments about booster doses and whether we're going to need them and when, but also because Arkansas is seeing the highest infection rate in the country right now. And simultaneously, perhaps not coincidentally, it also has among the lowest vaccination rates. Just 35% of the population of Arkansas is fully vaccinated. So I just wanted to see what was going on there and how he was feeling about things. He's obviously very worried. And he noted that, as we've heard from a number of places, the average age of people who are being hospitalized with COVID right now has come down a decade from where it was in the peak of things. And he also said he's really worried about kids and the virus. He said they've been seeing outbreaks in daycares and other enclosed settings like that. And it's getting him really worried about the upcoming school year. Also because we have seen sort of a slow uptake of the vaccine among kids 12 and older. And of course, there was that whole blow up in Tennessee over the person who's in charge of vaccine programs in that state, just making available information about whether minors can seek vaccination without parental consent. She was fired from her job. And now there's reporting from the Tennessean that the state is trying to roll back efforts on childhood vaccinations in general. And so Arkansas being a neighbor to Tennessee, I asked Dr. Romero about that. And he said in their state, they haven't seen any kind of diminishing in childhood vaccinations in general, but he is really trying to encourage parents to get kids vaccinated before school starts, at least for the 12 plus who can. One bright spot though, guys, in an otherwise sort of scary conversation, was he noted that their governor, Asa Hutchinson, has been going out all around the state into rural areas and having these COVID town halls where he answers questions from people about the vaccine and tries to help them feel more comfortable about taking it. And I saw some local coverage from Arkansas showing that some people were actually changing their minds and getting vaccinated after hearing from the governor in this setting. And Dr. Romero said he thinks Asa Hutchinson might be the only governor doing things like that. And it just seemed like, you know, one by one, maybe this is making a little bit of a difference.
Well, that's good to hear. And of course, it comes with the sort of alarming and dire predictions of how things could go, especially in the American South, if vaccination rates stay low as we move into the fall. And also dovetails with, you know, as we've talked about quite a bit, the politicization of the vaccine rollout, which we're going to touch on a lot more with Dan Diamond in a few minutes.
I find the whole thing just sort of infuriating and frustrating. I don't know what adjective to use, but, you know, the Delta variant, obviously highly infectious and a concern, but at the same time, I mean, you're seeing all of this scientific evidence that says that if you vaccinated and you're protected against COVID, you know, like if you, you know, you're protected against the Delta variant, like it's not, you know, and if you get infected, then you have mild cases. So it just boggles the mind that, you know, we live in a society that, you know, we have these people who just don't want to get vaccinated and now they're the repercussions of that, you know, it's not just them. It's obviously it has more widespread implications for people.
And to just button this up where we started, I mentioned Dr. Romero is the chair of ACIP. They are going to have a meeting on July 22nd, and they just put out the agenda. And on it is a discussion of potential booster shots for people who are immunocompromised. And so this could be potentially the beginning of what we've seen in Israel and France and perhaps the UK, although they might be boosting more broadly, to consider the first round of booster shots after that whole blow up about Pfizer and the accusations that it was premature to talk about boosters. Now the CDC's advisory group is going to talk about boosters.
So what would a episode of the Read Out Loud be without an update on Aduhelm, our favorite Alzheimer's drug? Damien, what happened this week?
Right. So the latest, as the New York Times reported on Wednesday, is that two major hospitals, the Cleveland Clinic and Mount Sinai here in New York, have decided that they're not going to administer Aduhelm, Biogen's treatment for Alzheimer's disease, basically because they don't believe that the data that's publicly available supporting the drug's approval actually demonstrate a benefit for patients such that they would give it to their patients. And obviously what comes into that is Biogen's decision to charge $56,000 a year for the average patient as a list price. And when you combine those two things, those two major hospitals just don't see a pharmacoeconomic benefit, I guess, for administering the drug. And the interesting thing, I mean, it's just two hospitals, it's a big country, but one wonders if this is sort of the beginning of a domino effect. It comes on the heels of private insurers in some cases declining to cover the drug. We know that the federal agency that oversees Medicare is examining whether to make just kind of a sweeping decision as to whether it will pay for the drug for certain patients. And it just seems like kind of a gathering storm that was perhaps predictable considering everything that went into Aduhelm's approval and the data that support it. But yeah, we're kind of just seeing this play out beat by beat over the past few weeks.
Do you guys know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of when Peter Bach and Leonard Saltz came together and said they were going to refuse to use Sanofi's cancer drug Zeltrap. That was over the price, but it was, as you said, the beginning of a domino effect of trouble for that drug. Do you think that other hospital systems are going to come out and do the same now with Aduhelm? And what does this mean for this drug and then this sort of space in general, where, as you guys pointed out at the Stat Summit in the interview with Dave Ricks, the CEO of Lilly this week, I mean, they're following suit in the waves of Aduhelm.
Yeah, I think in some respect, you know, the decision by the Cleveland Clinic and Mount Sinai to not use Aduhelm maybe is not all that surprising, given that, you know, we know that a lot of physicians out there who specialize in Alzheimer's have been, you know, against the drug, don't believe in the science, the data. So it naturally sort of follows that now that it's approved, they wouldn't use it. And like Damien pointed out, you know, there are a lot of doctors or a lot of hospitals out there. I mean, but but you can't deny the fact that the Cleveland Clinic, Mount Sinai are, you know, probably influential. I mean, they're big name medical centers, and other groups may sort of follow suit, you know, based on what they do. And that may be influential. So we'll just have to see. I mean, you know, I think it'll be next month when Biogen reports, their earnings, and they're going to have a conference call, obviously. And so it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, obviously, it'll be incredibly early, right, the sort of the initial uptake of the drug. But it will be interesting to see what Biogen says about, you know, that kind of initial launch.
Yeah. I mean, one thing to, you know, looking at this almost, I guess, holistically, I remember getting a tip months ago that the Cleveland Clinic was already preparing to administer the drug that would become Aduhelm in the event that it were approved. This is before we knew it would get approved. And I remember kind of chasing that down and it didn't really go anywhere. But that's interesting to me because it would suggest that, you know, the data haven't changed. The Cleveland Clinic people knew everything that they know now about Aduhelm's efficacy and safety back then. So one wonders if, you know, they always took a dim view of it, but kind of just saw which way the wind was blowing. But once there was this almost universal backlash to the approval, then they felt empowered to make this decision that they otherwise would have made. That's speculation on my part. But, you know, if something like that is the case, then you can imagine, as you said, my kind of a domino effect of other hospital systems feeling empowered to make similar decisions.
Yeah, and it hasn't helped that the FDA obviously backtracked on the label, you know, narrowed the label down, and also really has not come forth with an explanation for how the drug was approved. And you know, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, I think that probably plays into all of this as well.
The last thing I'll just add to this is it does make me wonder, you know, you start to think about, okay, well, if these major systems are not going to administer the drug, patients who are well-connected and able to do so will probably seek it elsewhere. Other patients who aren't so lucky will probably not be able to do that. And I don't know what the patient makeup of these two places is, and if they serve a lot of less fortunate patients who might be seeking this drug. I mean, this is a $56,000 a year drug before insurance, so already there are going to be access issues potentially. But this does kind of make me wonder if this will just exacerbate that kind of have and have not situation with Aduhelm.
So pivoting to the future of the FDA, Stat just had its Breakthrough Science Summit, and among the sessions was an interview with acting FDA Commissioner Janet Woodcock with our colleague Nick Florco. And one of the, I guess, nuggets of news that came out of that is she confirmed that under federal law, she has only until November in this acting role. And if she is not nominated and confirmed to be the permanent FDA commissioner, she will have to step down at that time, which I think, you know, kind of colors the way we're going to look at the organization moving forward, and is sort of inescapable from, as we touched on before, the ongoing Aduhelm controversy and its FDA approval.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Damon, I thought that was one of the more interesting parts. I mean, it was a great interview, and her talking about her own kind of future at the FDA was really interesting, because I think there had been this speculation, like, you know, she's the acting FDA commissioner, would the law allow her to stay on indefinitely? We know there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement on naming either her or anybody else as a permanent FDA commissioner. So I do feel like what came through the media interview was like she was a little bit, obviously she was kind of defensive. And I think she's also, it seems like a little stressed about like what her future role might be. Like, you know, she hasn't been named the permanent FDA commissioner yet. And so it seems like that is a problem. Like it seems, you know, I think we all assume that she probably would get the job, but the fact that it's gone this long seems to suggest that that may not happen. And I think as Nick pointed out in the interview, you know, she's already given away her permanent job, you know, to somebody else in the agency. So like that seat is taken. So what would happen to her? Like, would she have to retire? Like, there's so many unknowns that came through in the interview.
Yeah. And I'm not sure we really got a ton of answers about that. You know, one of the other things that I think the interview illustrated was that it could be a tough confirmation process for Janet Woodcock if she is nominated as FDA commissioner. Just the litany of things that Nick asked her about just showed how long a career she had, you know, at the FDA. She's been there for so long, and she's been involved with so many issues that have become extremely controversial. I mean, opioids has already been an issue that she's been criticized for a lot. But then also, you know, the eteplirsen, the Sarepta Duchenne muscular dystrophy drug, and now Aduhelm, the Alzheimer's drug we talk about constantly. I think that is going to be a cause of a lot of questions for her if she is nominated, even though she wasn't directly involved in the process of approving the drug. And I think Nick's series of questions sort of revealed that it's just a thorny issue for Janet Woodcock.
Yeah, and during the interview, you know, she acknowledged, and I think this was some of the news made from the interview, you know, she acknowledged that there's the possibility that there were issues or problems with the process, the way the FDA reviewed the drug, and, you know, sort of alluding to the reporting that Damien and I and Matt Herper have done in recent weeks. But let's listen to that bit of the interview right now.
Do you have any regrets about how the FDA has handled the approval of Aduhelm?
Well, let's separate it into two parts. Number one, I believe that the approval, as I said at the very beginning, is very solid, that the accelerated approval is based on very solid grounds, and that I do believe that will play out over time as people see that was a very appropriate use of that authority and the right thing to do for patients. Now, was the process done exactly best that it could be? Possibly not. We like to be as open and transparent as possible. We like to, you know, deal with, and I think they did, were very open and transparent about disagreements. that it occurred. So it's possible that the process could have been handled in a way that would have decreased the amount of controversy involved.
So that was striking at the time, and obviously it gathered a lot of attention of Janet kind of allowing for this possibility. But at the same time, it does kind of follow logically with her decision last week to call for an independent investigation into the FDA process. And she emphatically said this week, as well as in the past, that she stands by the approval decision and you know, has faith in the staff of the FDA, et cetera, et cetera, but invites this investigation and allows for this possibility that there were missteps in the process, I think, in the name of transparency. But I think, you know, I feel like I'm kind of bearing the lead here, because I think what got a lot of people's attention from Nick's interview was how flustered Janet Woodcock clearly was by his repeated questions, specifically about Aduhelm, about the backlash to the FDA's decision, about the relationship with Biogen, etc. There were points where she interjected, "I think we ought to move on." At one point, she said, "This is an interrogation right now." And, you know, obviously, I'm biased. Nick is my colleague and my friend. I thought that he was doing his job as a reporter by asking follow-up questions. But, you know, Meg, to your point earlier, you know, if she were to be nominated for this job on a non-acting basis, she would have to sit before a Senate that is, I shouldn't say full of, but that features many prominent critics of hers and of the FDA's. And they will be more forceful probably than Nick was. And they also, you know, will be able to vote on her future there. So I wonder, you know, if some of the reaction to the interview and the ensuing discomfort, I could say I felt uncomfortable watching it, you know, how much of that kind of casts a shadow over what could be the process over the next few months with respect to her job?
She's going to have to become better prepared to any, you know, any Senate confirmation hearing than she seemed to be with Nick.
Washington Post reporter Dan Diamond has become to health policy personnel reporting what Ronan Farrow is for the Me Too movement. He and his then Politico colleague Rachna Pradhan broke a series of stories early in the Trump administration about Health Secretary Tom Price's use of taxpayer money for private and government planes, leading to multiple federal inquiries and ultimately Price's resignation.
More recently, he broke the news that former FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn had moved to flagship pioneering the venture fund that birthed Moderna, and this week that the Biden administration would nominate Dr. Rahul Gupta, a former West Virginia health official, to lead its Office of National Drug Control Policy.
We wanted to talk to him about all of this and more. Dan joins us now. Dan, welcome to the Read Out Loud.
Thank you for having me. Though I don't know if you're looking for a health reporter or an HR expert. It sounds like maybe both.
I think you combine them nicely.
So, Danielle, thanks for coming on the show. And, like, what's on top of your mind these days covering health policy? What's going on down there in D.C.?
The evolution from Trump to Biden has also been an evolution for me. I was at Politico last year. I came over to the Washington Post the day before Inauguration Day. So the way that I've tried to cover health policy has shifted somewhat. At Politico, it was very much about being, you know, the insider's insider, knowing what was going on inside the Humphrey Building or inside the FDA. And I think now my focus has tried to be taking what is happening in Washington and expanding it out. So a lot of that has been around the vaccination drive. What can the White House do to boost shots? What are we doing with our global policy? What's happening with vaccine hesitancy? And is there any recourse for someone like President Biden to reach holdout Republicans? So those are some of the things that are top of mind today. And in fact, like a story that's going out even as we're talking gets to some of this.
Well, I know we wanted to ask you more in depth about the vaccine hesitancy issue and how it dovetails with politics in a second. But I was curious, you know, to your point about that transition, you know, externally, the Trump administrations and Biden administration communicate quite differently, present themselves quite differently, have a different cast of characters. But what's it like? What has it been like kind of on the ground dealing with sources and dealing with, you know, the relative PR people and et cetera, comparing the Trump admin to the Biden admin?
That's such a good question, Damian. I think all four of us can speak to how different sourcing can be over time. But for me, there's always been three basic categories of sources. One, I think of them as the patriots. the people who maybe they saw something wrong, they tried to get it fixed, they come to the media almost as last resort and are hoping for something good to come of it. Those are usually the best sources. There's a second group of sources that I think of as knife fighters, people who might have been in a meeting, didn't get their point of view across. They want to make sure that it shows up somewhere, so they're talking to you too. Their information might not be wrong, but you just have to know that there's some bias associated with it. And then there's a last group that I think of almost as tourists, people who saw something interesting or maybe just think it's fun to talk to a reporter. Their tips can be all over the map. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, but you kind of have to take them with the biggest grain of salt. During the Trump administration, there was a lot of all three. So there was a lot of reporting where you kind of play those groups off against each other, make sure you were talking to the different folks. And then there were the tourist types who, because there was such a movement of what crazy thing is happening in the government. I remember getting a tip in early, I think it was 2017, it might have been at JPM, where someone came with this like wild tip about Trump that I tried for years to break that tip and nothing ever came of it. But all three of those groups have retrenched somewhat. There are a lot of government officials who don't want to get on the wrong side of Biden. They think he's doing a much better job running the government. They don't want to be the ones to screw it up. There's less knife fighting. Not to say that there aren't fractures within the administration, but there have been so many Obama alums, for instance, who have come back and repopulated the government. They already have worked together. There isn't some fifth column of people who had never worked in government before, like during the Trump era. And then in terms of tourists, people who might see something interesting, those folks still exist, but I think we have to take them with an even bigger grain of salt. In a world where there are fewer big scoops and stories every day, I worry that sometimes the smaller things get elevated in that void, and I want to make sure that I'm not taking some fringy thing that someone may have seen and putting it into a context that it doesn't deserve.
That's super interesting. I expect that you will tell us the that tip that you were trying to chase down maybe after the recording. I don't expect you to tell us on the recording, but I desperately want to know what it was, just for personal edification.
Deal.
You know, one of the things you mentioned, and something I've experienced too, and I certainly do not cover administrations as closely as you do, but through just even covering the vaccine process from sort of the pharmaceutical coverage perspective, just so much more discipline from the Biden folks than from the Trump folks, as you were just talking about. So how do you really dig in and try to get to the heart of what they are doing and what's happening with things like the vaccination push, rather than just the message they want to put out there of we're all in this together and we're going to make progress one by one? Like, how do you really like kind of get under that very disciplined messaging and explain what's really happening in Washington on this issue?
Oh, Meg, that's a smart question, but it's also a very favorable one, because I'm sure if you ask the Biden White House, they might say that I don't do that and I get things wrong. But my perspective is that this administration is so on point, so on message. No one wants to get in front of the president, whereas Trump created a culture of leaking, so it was very easy to find people who felt empowered to get in front of what the White House would do. What I think I've tried to do, and I hope reasonably well in the vaccine push, is find those holes that enough informed people, whether in government or very close to it, have been privately grumbling about. And the more you push and push and push, and maybe it takes more phone calls than it did during the Trump era, but the more you dig into, say, failures on the global vaccination side, you can start finding those fissures. And eventually you do find the person who's inside or relatively close to the government who knows enough about what's going on to speak up. And it is a little bit slower too. I think during the Trump era, we might have gotten wind of some of this stuff 24 hours after the meeting that went sour. Now it's taking more like a few days or even a couple weeks. When the Biden administration first started, there were a bunch of people going in who freely talked to me last year, or had talked to me, you know, even back during the Obama era. And when I reached out to three or four people, it almost felt like they were reading from a script. They would say, "Dan, thank you so much for your reporting. It's been so helpful during the Trump administration. It's helped fix X, Y, or Z in healthcare. Unfortunately, I can't talk to you now." And it's like, you know, the reason that reporting was good was because people were talking to me. I need you to keep doing it. So there has been some softening of that, but it has been a harder road to get things out of this administration, which is so not only well scripted, but the decisions sometimes rest in smaller circles and are only communicated out at a later date.
So, Dan, you were early to the story of the vaccine push and how politics have kind of intruded upon that, and upon the effort to get people vaccinated with the COVID vaccine. How did we get to this point, and where are we going with that?
It's been a little bit depressing, Adam. I mean, the path of getting from there to here, some of it was clear at the time. We wrote a story back in April, I think, about how Republicans didn't want to hear from Tony Fauci. 3 months later, the Biden administration still is relying on him as a key communicator. I'm not sure that that's reaching these holdout Republicans. I also think in the story that just went up today with Tyler Pager and Hannah Knowles, we've seen Republican vaccine hesitancy metastasize into vaccine hostility, going even beyond coronavirus vaccines. And that's really disturbing. I've talked to a bunch of Trump officials about it who don't want to go on the record about this, interestingly, because they're worried that if they do, they will lose their ability to speak to the Trump population. It's a little bit cowardly, I think. But the idea that this is something burbling in the base, much like challenges to the election or the allegation that the election was stolen from President Trump, these things are almost marching to the same beat. And I know at the beginning of the Biden administration, the White House didn't really want to touch this. They were worried that the more they did, even acknowledging this problem, would add fuel to it. Things have shifted, and Biden and his team are starting right now to more aggressively go after what they say is vaccine disinformation.
So, Dan, we were talking about early on this podcast the sort of state of Janet Woodcock, the acting FDA commissioner, and the confirmation that she has, I guess, until November under the Vacancies Act, unless she is formally nominated and confirmed. What are you hearing about basically who's going to lead the FDA for the near future?
Well, first, I thought Nick Florco really put the screws to her in that interview. I mean, everyone's talking about it. So what a win for Stat to be the news driver there. And then second, should I confess all my reporting about the next FDA commissioner on the Stat podcast? I don't know. I will say that Lori...
Yes, please.
my colleague Lori McGinley has been running point on this for the Post, and she's a great FDA reporter. So I will defer to
we
her
love
on
Lori.
That. And you did introduce me kindly as a personnel expert, I will say, on some of that, especially the Tom Price stuff. Rachna Pradhan, my great colleague at Politico, was the one who got the first tip on Tom Price, so would not have broken anything if not for that. But when it comes to the FDA, I've actually been asking kind of a different question. And I say this with some trepidation, but I've been asking some of my sources, what happens if Biden doesn't nominate someone? Why are we assuming that that's going to happen? Now, I'll say this on your podcast, and tomorrow he'll nominate Janet Woodcock permanently. I don't know. But it does strike me. We just got through an administration that had a lot of acting leaders, including acting FDA commissioner for much of 2019. And then there were Obama officials like Andy Slavitt was never confirmed. And some would say he was a great acting administrator of CMS. So I was immediately told by all my sources that it was a bad question and that FDA does need a full-time leader just to make big political decisions and avoid being steamrolled. But I do think it's just an interesting thing to kick around in a world where we've seen people like Josh Sharfstein dangled out there for months and now Janet Woodcock. If these people were the obvious choice, why haven't they been chosen? You know, the longer someone sits, the less likely in some respects that person becomes.
Well, before we let you go, you mentioned that you have a connection to one of our colleagues at Stat. Tell us about that.
So I don't think I'd be in journalism at all if not for the help of Matthew Herper, who helped find me when I was at a consulting firm about 10 years ago. And Forbes, where Matt was at the time, was bringing on contributors. This was their like big push. And over time, I was able to write more and more, and Matt kept setting me up for really interesting things. And as a result, in part of my Forbes work, I was able to go to Politico and become a full-time journalist for the first time. So I have a lot of fondness for Matt and gratitude for what he did for me.
So Dan, your reporting is a central read. So thanks for sharing some of that insight with us today on the podcast.
I love Stat. I have a lot of affection for the people inside, and it's a true honor to be here. So thanks for having me.
That does it for another episode of The Read Out Loud.
Thank you to Teresa Gaffney for producing this week's episode.
Our senior producers are Hyacinth Empanado and Alyssa Ambrose.
Our executive producer is Rick Burke.
And our theme music is by Brian Joel.
And we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you like about this week's episode, what you didn't like, and whether you'd be up for an interview with Nick Florco about the most recent controversial thing in your life. You can do all of that by sending us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And if you like what we do, leave a review or a rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
See you next week.